She makes sure that I don't have any change in my pocket or I don't, you know, tap on the podium or... I think she'd rather have me speak naked, but she, y'all, I think Milton would frown on that. I'm really glad, really, really glad that she's here with me today. She's the love of my life, and I love her very, very much, and I'm very grateful to have her here with me. I'm also grateful to have the folks that were there when I got here with me. There's a lady here today that's my grand sponsor and great grand sponsor. And I'm very, very grateful to have her here and some friends of mine that go to my home group. And, you know, I just love Avalon. I love everything about it. I love the things that I don't like about it. I mean, I love everything there is about it. You know, everything that I am today, everything that I have today, every good thing that's ever happened to me, not that's ever happened to me, but every good thing that I have today is because of the program of Al-Anon. Everything. Because when I got here, I didn't have anything. I had nothing. I was thinking on yesterday how it is that I got from how I grew up to how I ended up to how I got here. And that's really what I need to tell y'all today. And I could tell you it was not because of how I grew up. My mother and daddy, they loved me. And they gave me everything that I ever needed and a whole lot of what I wanted. They were church-going, God-fearing people, good Christian people. They raised me right. They took me to church every Sunday morning, every Sunday night. They taught me every Wednesday night. That's just what we did. My best friend growing up was the preacher's son. We had preachers come into our home on a real regular basis and staying in our house. I was around a whole lot of real spiritual people. And I was around a whole lot of people who thought they were real spiritual. Sometimes that's kind of hard to distinguish between the two. What I'm trying to tell you is that my parents raised me right. They taught me the difference between right and wrong. And they gave me something that I don't know that a lot of people get. They gave me a fundamental belief and a grounding in the God of my understanding. And they taught me a whole lot about God. Now, as I got older, I somehow lost that. Or I don't know that I ever had it, but somehow I got away from that. But one of the things that Al-Anon, one of the many, many, many things that Al-Anon gave me back was the God of my understanding. I got two brothers. They're a year, I don't know how you say that. Right now, we're a year apart, so... I'm 47, 45, 46, and 47. And I've got a sister that's 8 years older than I am. And somehow or another, you hear this a lot, and I know it's kind of maybe even a cliche, but it really was true for me. I just felt different. I just felt like I was different growing up. I felt like there was something wrong with me. My mom can tell me that when I was little, I used to just cry myself to sleep because I felt I was no good. That there was something fundamentally wrong with me, that there was some kind of flaw within me. And I know that to be true because when I was 7 or 8 years old, my grandfather, who I was named after, and I was his favorite, he took me to Florida. Just me and my grandmother and him. And we went down to Panama City and went over to Jacksonville and went down to St. Augustine. And he loved Florida. And he took me. And I can remember telling him, you know, I don't deserve to go. You know, my brothers need to go. I don't need to go. I don't need to go. And that's just how I just felt less than. I just felt like there was something wrong with me the whole time growing up. Now, early on, what that did for me was I cried. I cried a whole lot. And I would go into my sister's room and leave my brothers in their room, because we all slept in the same room growing up when I was little bitty. I'd go in my sister's room and just kind of isolate myself, and that's how I was. But as the older I got, what that turned into was anger. And the older I got, the angrier I got. And I don't know one of the things that the steps helped me begin to see was that anger was fear for me. I think I've always been afraid, just afraid of being a failure, just afraid of just not, you know, just fear. That's who I am, fear-based person. Anyway, the older I got, the more angrier I got. And when I get angry, when I get afraid, I do one of two things. I get angry or I cry. And I stopped crying a long time ago, and I got angry. Growing up, like I said, I was raised in the church. When I was in the seventh grade, I went to a private Christian high school, and we had chapel every day, and my whole life, everything about me, everything about our family, everything about the friends that I had, everything around me, all of that was all about the church and all about Christianity and all about learning about God and knowing God. I didn't know anybody that drank growing up. I didn't know anybody that did any drugs or anything like that. I just wasn't exposed to a whole lot of that. My folks didn't drink, you know. It was a real big deal, you know. I can remember my folks used to have an open house. We had a pretty big house, and we'd have an open house, and we'd have all these people come, and, you know, she would make a rum cake, and that was a big deal. You know, everybody made a big joke out of the fact that there was a rum cake in the house. That was the extent of the alcohol use in our home growing up. But there was always that sense within me that there was something wrong with me, and that there was something out there better than what I had. And I tried to fill it up with some different things, you know, in the beginning and early on, and really what I turned to the most was relationships with women. I wanted to have a relationship. I wasn't very good at it, but I wanted to have, felt like if I could get the right girl that somehow that would fill me. And I liked to drink. You know, I drank some, you know. In fact, when I was 17 years old, I was dating a girl, and we went over to a girlfriend of hers house, and me and her folks and a bass singer for a gospel quartet sat around at the piano drinking all night and singing gospel songs, and that was the night I wound up at the Bessemer City Jail. But the one thing that alcohol did to me that I just couldn't tolerate was the hangovers. You know, I get more than three or four drinks in me, and I was destined to have a pretty bad hangover, and I just don't do good with pain of any kind. And it would take me three or four days to get over a hangover. And they say, whoever they are, that alcoholics don't have a whole lot of willpower. I don't know, you know, if it would have taken a whole lot of willpower for me to drink, you know, to drink through those hangovers. But, you know, I just never could. That didn't do it for me. And I didn't know, like I said, I didn't know anybody that did drugs or anything like that. And they scared me. And, my belief was, and I was told, that if you did drugs, you were going to die. So I didn't do any of that. And I just, you know, I was all the time reaching out for something or somebody. Mostly it was somebody that would help me feel better, because I wanted to feel better. I wanted to feel normal. I wanted to be normal, whatever that was. Joe and I met when we were 10 years old. She was the first girl I ever dated. She was the first girl I ever kissed. She was the first girl that ever told me that she loved me. And she was the first girl that I ever fell in love with myself. But I smothered her. And I hovered over her. And I, I just, you know, we had this love-hate relationship, I guess. And we broke up and got back together and broke up and got back together and broke up and got back together all through high school. But I got her because she moved off to Minnesota when we were about 16 or 17 years old. And while she was, I don't know if I ever told you this, baby, but there was another woman. And, I started dating this other girl from Toadvine, Alabama. And I think I went out with her maybe twice. But, you know, Joe was in Minnesota and out of sight, out of mind. So I broke up with her the last time. It was the first and only time I ever got one over on her. So, but, you know, like I said, I wanted to wrest satisfaction from a relationship with somebody or something or, you know, anything outside of me. And, you know, like I said, I was taught that God was the answer. I was, you know, I believe I was given some really good information growing up, that God could do for me what I couldn't do for myself, that He loved me, that He cared about me, that He wanted to have a relationship with me. And I believe that that was the answer for me. And every time something really bad happened, whether, you know, a girl broke up with me or, you know, I have a hard time I guess I'm clumsy. I've broken my ankles four or five times. I've cut my hand off with a power saw, broke my left arm. I've done a lot of physical harm to myself without really meaning to. And anytime something like that happened, I'd always turn to God, you know. God, if you'll help me get through this, if you'll help me through this, whatever this problem is, and I'll do whatever you say. I'll go wherever you want me to go. I'll do whatever you want me to do, you know. And I mean it. Every single time I mean it. But I just didn't know how. I mean, I just didn't know how, you know. The church told me, don't get me wrong, I love the church. I go to church today. It's a real integral part of my recovery today. But what I heard the church tell me, and I don't know that they said this, but what I heard the church tell me was that if I would come down and ask God to forgive me and ask Him to take over my life, that everything would be lovely from then on out. And I expected to go to sleep one way and wake up a different way. And I always went to sleep one way and always woke up the same way. And I never did understand that. I didn't understand that it took a program of action. You know, there is a fellowship and there's a program of action. And I was all about the fellowship, but I didn't know anything about a program of action. You know, the church group would go off and do this thing or that thing, or we'd have these revivals or these meetings or whatever. I have a good friend of mine. His name is Brom, and his son recently died, and he just means a whole lot to me. And he was one of those guys that I believe was a really spiritual man. Didn't know anything about AA or Al-Anon, but he was a very spiritual. He is a very spiritual guy. And I can remember him coming to me when I was 16, 17 years old, saying, "Philip, if you don't, you know, if you don't straighten yourself out, you're going to get in bad, bad trouble." You know, and I just blew him all off. You know, and I just didn't know how to do that. I did not know how to have a relationship with God. You know, I felt like that if I needed to ask Him, and then He would bring down to me whatever, you know, wave a magic wand or whatever, and then, like I said, I'd just wake up different. And it never, ever happened for me, ever. What did happen was I just got angrier and angrier. I got more and more frustrated with how my life was going. I had a very, very poor choice maker, you know. Every choice I made seemed to be the bad choice, the wrong choice. I just, you know, I didn't know how to make good choices. I just made, you know, if there was a good choice or a bad choice to make, invariably, I always chose the bad choice, always. And what happened was I just got angry. You know, I would suffer the consequences for those choices, and I would get more angry. And I would say, well, why, God, you know, I ask you to help me. Why didn't you help me? Why is it like this? Why do I keep doing these things? Why does these things keep happening to me? Why? You know, and really and truly, they were not bad things. I mean, you know, I hear some of these guys get up here and talk, and their lives were just completely horrible. Just, you know, just a rolling, running train wreck. And that just, you know, really and truly, I'm 47 years old, and I can look back and see the hand of God in my life over and over, and how He protected me and cared for me and looked after me and did for me. And, you know, but back then I just couldn't see any of that. And I just got angrier and angrier and angrier. When I was a senior in high school, I was dating a girl. She went up north somewhere to see a friend of hers. When she came back, she broke up. She met some guy, and she broke up with me. And again, I said, well, I'm going to ask God to, you know, please help me get through this, if you'll just help me do. And there, during that time, I made a decision that I would go to overseas to a Bible school. Felt like if I just, my parents knew this guy that was big overseas, and he had these string of Bible schools all around the world, and I had an opportunity to go to Switzerland. They were going to pay my way, so I went. And I figured if I go over there and spend 9 months over there and they teach me all about God, then when I come back, I'm going to know how to do this deal. And I'm going to tell you, I went over there and I learned a whole lot about God, a whole lot about it. We had 5 classes a day, an hour a day. We spent all, you know, and we lived and breathed the Bible and God and all of that. And I was, you know, I was going to come back a spiritual giant. And, you know, when I came back, I was more angry when I got back than I'd ever been. I just didn't know why. I had no idea why. To tell you the truth, today, I'm not sure I could tell you why, except that I was afraid. I was afraid of being a failure. I knew I was a failure. I came back and I got a good job. My uncle was the vice president of the IBEW, 5th district of the IBEW, and he got me a good job with Alabama Power Company. And I was going to be set for life. You know, you get on with power company. I mean, today I know guys that hired on after I did who are retired. You know, I could be retired right now. That's the kind of choices I make, because I quit that job because I was too smart for them. But I got a job with the power company, and I married a Bible school graduate. She went to Southeastern Bible College, and, you know, she was going to be a teacher. I mean, that's just what you did, you know. I looked a whole lot. I was a lot younger, but I had the same kind of haircut, you know, and I was a real conservative-looking guy, you know, and we went to church. We did everything that everybody thought, or I thought everybody said you were supposed to do. And we were married. I was about, I don't remember exactly, 24 maybe, 21, I don't remember. Anyway, we got married. We stayed married. We were married a couple of years, and I was working for the power company. And even in that job, it's a union job, and you're supposed to advance by seniority. You didn't advance by how good a job you did. You know, it was just a matter of how much time you had. But I hired on as a floor sweeper, and in 2 years, I had already jumped up 3 classifications. I mean, I was on my way. You know, I was making really, really good money, and I was married to a real nice girl, you know, a girl I didn't know and a girl that I didn't love and a girl that I didn't really, you know, I didn't know anything about loving somebody. I don't know what that meant. You know, I was on my way, I thought. Well, I got restless, irritable, and discontented, you know. Nothing was ever, that's what happens. You know, everything gets okay and everything goes smooth, and I'm thinking, this is boring as all get out. You know, I just, every day I got to get up and I got to drive to work and I get off at 3:30 and I come home and there's no, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I decided, I got to thinking about growing up. And I remember, I don't know how old I was, but we lived across the street from Western Hills Mall, and I went across to the Woolworths at Western Hills Mall when I was just a kid, and I bought a Three Dog Night record, Live at the Forum. And when I brought it home, my mama made me take it back. And I knew right then that was something I needed to be involved in. So when I 2 years into my marriage, 2 years into this job, well, actually it was 4 years into the job. I'd worked a couple of years before we got married. 2 years into this job, and 2 years or 2 years into the marriage and 4 years into the job, I decided I need to quit that job, that I need to go in the rock and roll business. That's what I needed to do. Didn't know anything about the music business, didn't know anything about the rock and roll business, but, you know, it was the antithesis of everything that I knew. It was the complete opposite of everything that I grew up with. It represented everything that I wasn't, and that's what I wanted to be, because I had tried all of what they had, and none of that worked. So that right there ought to be the ticket. And that's what I did. I quit my job. I went to UAB. I got on the UAB Entertainment Committee. We were called Center Stage Productions. And we got into rock and roll business. It was in the mid-80s. It was 81, 82, early 80s. We could get a lot of good bands real cheap. We got in good with a big promoter who needed to buy some bands cheap. And I'm going to tell you, I had a fantastic time. I got to do things and see things and go places that I never, ever would have had an opportunity to go and see and do. Went to New York City for a week, which that was a killer, because everybody else, they had things to help them, and I didn't have anything to help me stay up. And we spent 7 days awake. And for somebody that don't do any kind of, you know, have any outside influence to help you with that was tough. But I was young and I had a good time. I mean, I had a real good time. But you know what? In the end, when I went home at night, I still had the same thing I always had, you know. And I was getting angrier. Seemed like every day I go by, it went by, I get angry. And I was always looking, what can I get? What can I do? And like I said, I was never a big drinker. Never did drugs or anything like that. By that time, I knew a lot of people that did drugs, a whole lot of, I could have done, and you know, but it just wasn't for me. And but I don't really know exactly what happened. You know, it starts out innocently enough, like most things do. I had a friend, and we talked, and we seemed to talk a whole lot better than my wife and I talked. And next thing you know, I was having an affair, and next thing you know, I was divorced. And so, with the divorce came the loss of the money, because I didn't work. She worked. I went to school. I was in the rock and roll business. I didn't have time to work, you know. And so my money was gone. And so at 28 years of age, I find myself with no job, no wife, no prospect of a job, no future, you know, angry, pissed off at the world, nowhere to go, nowhere to do, nothing, no plans, nothing. I was primed for the ideal relationship, and I found it. I got by that time my hair was down about right here and had an earring. And back then you had to be careful which side you put your earring in. But I had an earring and I don't remember what side you had to have it in, but I had it in the correct side. Anyway, had the long hair and all this, you know, and I got my hair cut about once every 6 months or so. And this girl had cut my hair before I'd been divorced, but I went, had my hair cut, and you know, we got to talking and we decided that we needed to go out. So we picked a day. Of course, we met in a bar and we went out that night and we fell in lust right off. I mean, it was the perfect, I mean, everything about it was perfect. I mean, she was married to one guy, living with another guy, had two kids. I didn't have a job. I mean, it was perfect. You know, it was everything that any good relationship, you know, needs to be made out of. We had it all. You know, and besides, we love one another. We figured that out 10, 15 minutes after we met. You know, it was perfect. And what happened was we spent the next eight years in hell. I could go buy a case of beer, and I could drink one, turn around twice, and the rest of them be gone. That's just how she drank. And I got angry. I got angrier and angrier and angrier. I'm a plate thrower and a wall puncher. That's what I do the best. I like to take her by the throat and squeeze her till her head pops off. You know, I like to get her down on the floor and bang her head on the floor. You know, that's the kind of guy I am. Just a wife beater. That's what I was. I wasn't a drinker. I wasn't a drug taker. I was just angry. Angry, angry, angry. My sponsor describes waking up angry and going to bed in a blind running rage. I think I woke up in a blind running rage, and whatever comes after that, that's what I was. Just angry, mad at the world, angry, angry, angry. I can tell you, we spent maybe, you could probably count on one hand the number of days in a row that we spent, we had civil words with one another. It was awful. It was awful. But we tried. I tried. She tried. I knew that. At first, we lived together, and I knew that was wrong. Everything about me, you know, the way I was raised, that was wrong. You just don't do that. My mom was putting pressure on me for not doing that. Well, that meant I had to get married. Well, we were living in government-assisted housing. By that time, she quit her job, and I'd found a great paying, well-paying job, $6 an hour. And I woke up one morning, I said, you know, wait a minute. We got these two kids. I got a wife. You know, I think I need to be responsible. I think I need to learn how to be responsible. We can't do this anymore. We can't be drinking and carousing and doing all the stuff that we've always done. We can't, you know, it's time for us to grow up and be responsible. So I woke up one day and decided that's what we were going to do. And I was going to beat it into her if it killed me and her both. And it just didn't work. I mean, you know, it just don't work that way. I mean, you know, today I still have a tendency to believe sometimes that works. I mean, that's just how sick I am. But it don't work. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. But I tried. If it would have worked, I could have made it work because I was pretty good at it. Very, 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 very angry. I mean, it was a hellacious relationship. That's all there was to it. It was just, there was nothing about it that was any good. Nothing. There was no redeeming anything about that relationship whatsoever. But we tried. We tried to go to church. We had a preacher that did house calls. We had a guy that would come to our house and, you know, and I'd sit on one side of him talking about her, and she'd sit on the other side of him talking about me, and we spent all our time pointing the finger, and, you know, that's just what we did, and it just didn't work. And one day, on a Monday of a Thanksgiving week, by then I'd managed to get a job, a fairly decent job, and we'd had a couple of other kids, so we had four kids, and I came home on a Monday afternoon of a Thanksgiving week, and she met me out in the yard, and she said, I can't do this anymore. I cannot live this way anymore. I found somebody else. I'm leaving. Well, actually, she said, I'm finding somebody else, and you're leaving. And that's what I did. You know, by that time, I didn't have any friends. My mom, my brothers and sister long since quit talking to me. My mother, the only way she could talk to me was write me letters and send me letters in the mail because she couldn't talk to me. I had nothing, you know, and all I had was wrapped up in those four kids and her. And that four kids I didn't know and a wife I couldn't stand. That's where I was. But it was all I had, and I thought my life was over, like I always do. I always think my life is over. Whatever bad thing happens, no matter if it's little or big, my life is over. I'm going to die. My life is over. And the next few months, I can't really tell you what happened exactly. Her alcoholism escalated, and it was just a blur. Eventually, we got divorced, and by the time I got over the emotional turmoil of it all, I had decided that she was the problem, and this was a good thing because her being the problem is going away. So now that I've got the problem out of the way, I'm going to be okay. She came to me again. Well, this time it was on a Sunday evening. We were in the middle of trying to fight for who was going to keep the kids and this and that. And she said, she met me out in the front yard again and said, I can't raise these kids. You're going to have to do it. There were 3, 5, 7, and 12. And she said, I just can't do this. Her alcoholism had progressed to the point where she just couldn't keep it together. And she got in the car and she left. She left me with the 4 kids standing out in the front yard, and my problem had just left. And I'm thinking, this is perfect. I wrote the divorce decree. 3 days later, we were divorced. The problem is over. It's all over. And I don't know, sometime not too long after that, she called me and said, I need some help with my alcoholism. Can you help me? I said, yeah. We had an EAP at work, and I got her into a treatment facility. And she walked in the front door of the treatment facility and went downstairs to the detox unit, stayed 4 or 5 days, and went out the back door and kept on drinking. She's still drinking today. But during that time, I was sitting at the front lobby, and I wished I could tell you that I had reached down and picked up an Al-Anon pamphlet, but I didn't. They didn't have any there. I don't know that they have any there today. But I reached down on the little end table, and I picked up a pamphlet for the what they call the Affected Family Member Program. Well, at that particular treatment facility, they have what they call a family week. Well, I didn't go to the family week. She wasn't there long enough. In fact, while she was in there, she wasn't in there but just a few days, but she was over there over the course of a weekend. And this will tell you a little bit about how crazy I was. Over the course of the weekend, and that particular weekend, they have a picnic. I don't know that they have it anymore, but they used to have a picnic, and all the families and all past patients, all that would come to this picnic. Well, I went up there to the picnic. Well, we got in a knockdown, drag-out fight, and what got me was they kicked me out. They came to me and told me, you're going to have to go, and they kept her. I don't get it, but that's what happened. She, because I was still trying to get her to see my way. I used to scream at her at the top of my lungs, I'm right, I'm right, I'm always right. When I'm wrong, I'm right. I'm the husband and I'm right. That's the way it is, she was the problem. It's clear she was the problem. But I picked up this pamphlet. I said, what is this deal here? And I checked it out, and it was a kind of an outpatient deal. So I went to this outpatient deal. And it was me and about 10 women and a guy facilitator. And all the women would sit on one side of the room, and I would sit on this side of the room because I was angry. By that time, I had some things to be angry about. When you get kicked out of your house and some other guy moves in, In fact, I had taken a pipe one time about this long and went in there and beat the daylights out of all the tables at my work, and that was when I wound up in a psychiatric ward for about a week. I was angry. And all the women would sit on one side of the room, and I would sit on this side of the room, and it was a very intense deal. And the guy's name was Chuck. He would try to facilitate this deal. And about halfway through that, I don't remember exactly how it happened or what happened. We wound up out in the parking lot, me and him, and I was in his face, buddy, with my finger pointing in his face. I can see it right now. He was this close to me. I was pointing my finger in his face saying, you don't understand where I've been. You don't understand what it's like. You don't know anything about me or what I go through, nothing. You don't have any business trying to tell me how to live or tell me what. You don't have a, and I was ranted and raved. He just stood there smiling. Which really, really, really made me angry. I didn't know it till years later, but he was going to kick me off of that place. There was nothing that they could do. There was nothing anybody could do. He was going to kick me out of that, whatever that deal was. He just figured I was hopeless. But like I told you earlier, Somehow, God, see, it's not that I thought that God didn't love me or that God didn't care about me. What I thought was that God had given up on me, that he had done everything that he knew to do for me, and that there was nothing that he could do for me, and that he'd just given up on me. That's what I thought, that I was just too sorry a guy, that I was given the right raising, that I was taught right, I was given everything that I needed, a lot of what I wanted, everything going for me, and I blew all of it. And so God had done all he could do, and you're on your own, pal. That's what I thought. Somehow that day, Chuck saw something, and he let me stay. Thank you, God, that you let me stay. Because after that, I went into what they call an aftercare program. And it was on Thursday nights, started at 7 o'clock. And I went in, I sat down there, and the facilitator of that meeting, this was huge. It was a room about half this size, and there were sometimes 30 people in there. And the facilitator of that meeting, her name was Kathy King. She has since died of bone cancer. And she was one of those spiritual people. I can remember shortly before she died, me and a friend of mine went to see her, and I was all nervous and everything, you know. And by the time I left there, she knew why I was there. I was saying goodbye. And I knew why I was there. I was saying goodbye. But she made me feel so at ease, and I knew it was okay. That's the kind of woman this was. Even in her death, she exuded a spirituality, a God consciousness that I wanted and needed. Anyway, she facilitated this meeting. And I would go in there every Thursday night, and I'd belly ache and moan about how bad I had it. You know, just miserable, miserable person. You know, I thought the problem had left when she got in that car and left, but I was probably more miserable than I'd ever been. And she would look at me and she'd say, you know what, to me, it sounds like your life's been affected by alcoholism. And if you were to try Al-Anon, you might could find some relief. And I would say to her, you know, Kathy, you don't get it, do you? I work a 40-hour week. I got these four kids I'm raising. You know, I come here every Thursday night. What do you want? I don't have time to do that. And she'd say, fine. That's the way you want to keep living like you're living. You go right ahead. But I'm telling you that there is something out there for you if you're willing. Next Thursday night, I'd come and bellyache and moan about how miserable I had it and how awful a time I had it. And she would say, you know what? It sounds to me like your life's been affected by alcoholism. It may be that if you were to try an Al-Anon meeting, you could get the relief you needed. And I would do this over and over every week. Finally, I said, okay. And I, you know, quite frankly, I'd been to one of your meetings. And the meeting I went to, no offense taken, one of the meeting I went to, there was about 25 blue-haired ladies there, none of whom I could relate to, none of whom said anything that I needed to hear. I had no reason to be there. I had tried one of your meetings. It didn't work for me. The thing about it was that nothing else I tried worked either. Nothing else I tried worked. And I tried everything there was to try, everything. So when she said, maybe you ought to try an Al-Anon meeting, finally I said, okay. I don't know how I wound up at Bessemer. I don't know how I did. I lived in Hewittown. There was a meeting just about close enough for me to walk to. But God, for some reason, wanted me to go to Bessemer, and I wound up down at Bessemer. And I walked in there on a Wednesday night. There was maybe 6 or 8 people there. There was an older black lady. There was an older fellow, not quite old enough to be my dad, but older fellow. There was a couple of blue-haired ladies there. There was a girl there that looked, she probably wasn't, but she looked young enough to be my daughter. None of these people I had anything in common with. None of them. But you know what they did? They told me that they loved me and that they wanted me to come back. And they cared about me. And they said, you come on in and you sit down. And we love you. And we're glad you're here. And keep coming back. And I don't know. I don't know. I was at a place that I don't think In Al-Anon, you don't see it very much, unfortunately. I think you probably see it a lot in AA, because in AA, people are going to die real quick if they don't get what y'all have. In Al-Anon, you don't always see this. There are people in Al-Anon that do die. I was talking to a fellow not too long ago that had somebody in their home group who had taken a gun and shot herself because she just couldn't take it. So people in Al-Anon do die, but you don't hear of it very often. But I came to that place where I just didn't know what else to do, and I was willing to do, and I was at the end of my rope. So I was ready to come in and hear what y'all had to say. And that's the first thing I heard, was that they loved me. Me. They didn't care what I looked like. They didn't care how I dressed. They didn't care what I said. They didn't care, you know, what I did. All they knew was that I suffered from the same disease that they suffered from, a family disease that we call alcoholism, a disease that they didn't choose and a disease that I didn't choose. I didn't set out to marry an alcoholic. I didn't set out to live a miserable life. I didn't set out to be choking my wife and banging her head on the floor. That's not the way I was raised. But they had a solution that they knew I needed. And if I was willing to implement the spiritual principles that they had in my life, that my life could change. I didn't know that's what they were going to give to me when I got there. All I knew was that everything that I had done didn't work. There was a girl that came into that meeting. It's been 3 or 4 years ago. Put it better than probably as simply and as better than any way I've ever heard it put. She said, she came in, she sat down, she said, you know, I've just run out of options. Man, what a great place to be. Run out of options. When I run out of options, and I've got an open mind. I can hear what you have to say. As long as I've got this idea that I can do this one more thing, that I can say this one more thing, that I can get you to do this one more thing, that everything's going to be okay. As long as I've got an idea that there's something that I can do, then I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to get what y'all have. But when I come to the place like I was, and like so many of the guys that I sponsor have gotten to, when I can get to that place where I can say to myself and say to you, I've run out of options. I don't know what else to do. I give up. I'm through. I'm history. Then I can hear what you have to say. And when I came to that meeting on a Wednesday night, that's what I heard you say, tell me, that you love me and that you want me to come back. And that's what I did. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And you know what else that I found down there? I found an AA meeting down there that has some open meetings. And they let me come to your meetings. They let me hear what you had to say. You know, alcoholism is a family disease. I suffer from the same disease the AA suffers from, only different. I don't have a physical allergy. I could take a drink of alcohol and it doesn't do for me what it does to you. So I don't know anything about the physical part of that disease. But I can tell you, I know a whole lot about the mental obsession. A whole lot about the mental obsession. So while I don't know anything about that physical allergy, I do know something about the mental obsession. And fortunately, the solution for either one of those things and both of those things is the same. A program of action numbered 1 through 12. And that's what I found in that meeting on Wednesday night. I've been going to that meeting, and they told me early on, probably the first meeting I got there, now you need to get here early and to make sure you're prepared to stay late. So if I get there after 7:30, I feel guilty. Even today, 10 years later, I want to get there at least 30 minutes early. That's the way I was sponsored. That's the way I sponsor my guys. You need to be there early, and you need to be prepared to stay late. That's just part of doing the deal. So that's what I did. And one Wednesday night, I came in there, and I sat down, and there was a meeting. I didn't know anything about the steps. Hadn't been going there that long. Didn't know anything about the steps. I just knew that while I didn't know why, and I didn't understand why, and I couldn't really see exactly why, because looking at you didn't look like I'd have anything that y'all had anything that I wanted, but there was something that y'all wanted. So I kept coming back. And I came in there on a Wednesday night, and there was that little girl that looked young enough to be my daughter. She said, tonight we're going to have a meeting on step 9. And I said, there ain't no way I'm going to do a step nine. You can forget it. Because I knew what kind of guy I was. No way I'm going to do a step nine. She opened the meeting up. We were sharing on step nine, or they were, I wasn't, sharing on step nine. And there was a fellow sitting on the other side of the room. And he says, you know, before you do a step nine, there's going to be a step eight. And if you do a good step eight, that step nine ain't going to be no problem. He said, you know, before you do step eight, there's a step seven. If you work that step seven, eight, nine ain't going to be a problem. So by the end of that meeting, of course, he said, his point was, if you do steps one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, and eight, when you get to step nine, that's not going to be an issue. So at the end of that meeting, I came up to him and I said, Bo, I said, I don't really know exactly what this means, but I know I'm either going to have to work these steps or I'm going to have to quit coming. You know, I can't keep coming to these meetings and not get out of the problem and into the solution. And he asked me the most important question I've ever been asked in all of my life. He asked me if I was willing. I said, yes, sir, I am willing. I'll do whatever you say. And if he'd have told me to go in the backyard, dig a 40-foot ditch with a teaspoon, I'd ask him where to start. That's just how ready I was. I was willing to do whatever that man told me to do. And you know what he had that I needed? He had good sponsorship. Started with this lady right down here. Because she sponsored his sponsor. And she sponsored him. And he sponsored me. And he took me by the hand, and he took me into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous outside of that meeting. He took me by the hand, and we got in the book, and we started at step one, and my life changed. My life changed. I hadn't thrown a plate. I've wanted to, but I haven't thrown a plate since then. I haven't punched a wall since then. You know, my life changed. I'd like to tell you that my life became perfect. I'd like to tell you that everything about me changed and that all my whole life changed and that I never had another problem since then. But that's not true. But what it did was it gave me a set of spiritual principles that if implemented, I don't have to live like that anymore. I just don't. That doesn't mean I don't choose to sometimes, but I can't live that way long. Sometimes I go a few days. I've gone a few months living that way. But I can't live that way long and not be happy, joyous, and free. He instilled in me a set of spiritual principles. He gave me a gift. The gift of the program of action. That group taught me about the fellowship, but he taught me about a program of action. So that's what he did. He took me through those 12 steps and my life changed. That was 10 years ago. 3 years later, Joe called me. Now, Joe, I didn't believe this. Sometimes it's still hard for me to believe. But every time I talked to Joe, she'd tell me that she loved me. And what she does that I'm not very good at is that she shows me. She puts that into action. And one of the ways she did that for me, even through all the anger, through all the marriages, through all the crap, every year she'd call me on my birthday. She'd say, I just think about you and want to say hello. And see, I mean, it was nothing, you know, no kind of, I mean, she was married and I'd been married. And, you know, there was no kind of anything back. She just called me, tell me, you know, happy birthday. We'd see each other at funerals and weddings, mostly funerals. And, you know, well, 3 years after I came into the program, she called me and said, look, I need to move, and I wonder if you'd help me move. Well, Joe and I don't know what it is, but we've got it. Whatever it is, we got. You know, we've got this. She don't always see it, but we've got this. We got this something that just draws us together. And I was afraid of it. I was afraid of her. The guy, Chuck, you know, he told me one time, after I'd been in the program for about 3 years, he said, you know, you need to go out and branch out and start dating some folks. You need to start dating somebody that you feel likes a lot better than you, because you need to feel the rejection, is what he told me. So thank you. Well, that's kind of the way Joe was. You know, I just felt like she just, you know, she just exudes this. She's just a lot better than me, is what I thought. So anyway, she called me, and I was scared. I said, I don't know. It was my mother's birthday that weekend, and I begged off, and I said, I'm sorry, I can't. Well, and I'm not even going to try to remember the dates, because every time I do, I screw it up. But a little while later, she called me back, and she said, look, I got this one more piece of furniture. If you'll help me move this one piece of furniture, I'd really be appreciative. I said, okay, I'll help you do that. So I went over there, and she had another guy there. Me and him and her, I had a truck, and we went and got this piece of furniture and came back. We had a great time, just had a great time. And we unloaded a piece of furniture, and I took it in the house, and I went home. Well, she called me a little while later and said, you know, I wanted to ask you and Brack, the fellow that's helping us, I want you to come over and eat supper with me, just to thank, you know. Well, my mind had started working by then. And by the time she called me to ask me to have dinner with her, I figured she wanted me. And that, you know, that I had worked the magic, you know. And fortunately, the night that she chose, Brack couldn't show up. So I showed up at the door, and I think she's got three daughters, I got four sons. I got full custody of the kids. She had her kids at home, so she met me at the door, or one of the kids met me at the door, and I walked in. I don't even know that I ever said anything to her, but she was standing there in the kitchen, or in the little dining room thing, just looking like she does now, beautiful, just absolutely knockout gorgeous. I couldn't help it. I walked in, kissed her right square on the lips, and I don't know if I did it for her, but I can tell you she did it for me. And a year later, we were married. And we were married. And, you know, I'd like to tell you that our married life, our whole, we've been married for going on, well, June will be 7 years. And that's right? 7 years? Okay. I'd like to tell you that that for the past 7 years, that we've just lived in AA and Al-Anon heaven, you know, and that our whole, but it just hadn't been that way. We got married in June, and in August, our youngest daughter, Megan, she was raped while drunk on the beach. And that just sort of catapulted us off into several years of just pure alcoholism. That's what it is. I mean, alcoholism is a family disease. And I'm going to tell you, if Joe and I don't know anything else about this disease of alcoholism, we do know that it is a family disease. And it riddled our family completely. Completely and totally. I don't want to tell her story. I don't want to get involved in all that, because I'm going to tell you, she does a whole lot better job of it than me. Joe is, I have a lot of respect for her. She has a good program, and I don't want to tell you all who to get, but you know, you need to ask her, because she is a powerful speaker. But anyway, you know, our home was just filled with alcoholism. You know, we've had suicide attempts, runaways, teenage pregnancies. The first Christmas we were married, her father had a massive heart attack on Christmas Eve, New Year's Day. Joe was with him when he passed away. And, you know, we've had some very, very, very difficult times. Very, very difficult times. And I've not dealt with it well all the way through. And I don't want to get into all of that, but there was a reason why I told you that I wanted to introduce Joe, because there was a time not too long ago when I wasn't sure she was going to be here. Because this family disease that we call alcoholism, it has an effect on us, a powerful effect. And if I'm not able to stay spiritually fit, if I'm not able to put into action the principles that I was taught by my sponsor, and that my sponsor was taught by his sponsor, and that I try to teach the guys that I sponsor, if I don't do that, then that daily reprieve that the book talks about, I'm not going to have. Joe and I read that this morning. I have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I have got to maintain my spiritual condition. I've got to, because if I don't, I'm going to be back in that desperate place, that angry place, that resentful place. And I don't know about you, but it just don't work for me. It just does not work for me. I love Al-Anon. I love everything about it. Like I told you. Not too long ago, I was sitting in my boss's office, the owner of the company where I work. And in that office was his father, who owns what I call the mothership there in Tennessee. They've been in business for 35 years. His partner was sitting next to me. So it was the Most High's son, who was my direct boss, the Most High's partner, and me. And they were talking to me, and they wanted to hear what I had to say. Now, that don't have anything to do directly with Al-Anon. But I'm going to tell you the reason I was in that office. The reason I was in that office, and the reason they wanted to hear what I had to say was not because what I had to say was important. They wanted to hear what I had to say because of you. Because if I didn't have this program of action, if I didn't have the fellowship of Al-Anon, if I didn't have the program of the 12 steps of action, I wouldn't be in there. I wouldn't have my wife. I wouldn't have my job. I wouldn't have anything. I would have nothing. And that's what I thought when I was sitting in that room. I just sat there, and all of a sudden it just came over me. You know, Al-Anon did this for me. Al-Anon gave me this. You know, and I am so grateful. I am so incredibly grateful. I'm grateful for you. Thank you for letting me be here. I appreciate you letting me share.